And we're going to talk today about fatal asthma. And there's a lot of different ways to approach this topic. And I'm going to tell you up front, I'm not a cell biologist, a geneticist. So I'm going to focus more on the big picture. I'm an epidemiologist. And those will be the areas that I touch on the most. I'll also specifically address the concept of a national fatal asthma registry, since that was what Chris originally asked me to talk on. And I know that people in this room, including Al Scheffer, have championed this for many years. So we will cover some recent trends. I'll talk about the fatal asthma profile, and then I'll talk about registries and some of the challenges that we have experienced over the last few years working on this. And then you can't have a talk on fatal asthma without talking about long-acting beta agonists, or LABAs. And so I'll give you my own opinions on that controversy. In terms of fatal asthma, there are several different publications recently that summarize what's been happening from the CDC and then compiled very nicely every year by the American Lung Association. If you're not familiar with those sources, great place to get a picture on the prevalence, emergency department visits, hospitalizations, et cetera, for asthma, and including mortality. And the story, the main story of mortality, is shown on this slide. And what it presents is, by year, the number of asthma deaths in this country. And you can see that in recent years, there's been a very nice decline. And so that's the big headline, which is that I know working in the asthma field, it's often doom and gloom, and it's bigger, it's badder, you know, it will kill you. But actually, we do have a success story in all of this, which is actually declining mortality for asthma. And also, I can tell you from numerous other sources, declining emergency department visits for asthma, and even some evidence of declining hospitalizations. So although more people have asthma today than 20 or 30 years ago, a lot more, we're actually doing a much better job controlling the disease. And that's reflected in these outcomes such as mortality. Now, part of this decline is probably artifactual, and it relates to the fact that there was an ICD-9 change in the middle of this data collection. And so in the first few years when this decline was apparent, people dismissed it and said, no, that's not real, because of this switch from ICD-9 to ICD-10. And I've blocked out those years. But I think at this point you can see that the decline is quite real. It's continuing. And in the most recent year available, which is 2004, we were actually down to about 3,800 deaths. And this is out of a population of maybe 25 million Americans with asthma, with currently active asthma. So again, the story of asthma is largely about quality of life. It's the day-to-day limitations, symptoms. It's not the drama of the fatal asthma attack, although it certainly, you know, is of interest. And preventable condition, you'd certainly like to focus on it, but it's going well in that fatal asthma world, because you'll see these figures are actually similar to those in the late 1980s, when the number of people with asthma was much lower than it is today. There are many risk factors for fatal asthma. This is the list that was compiled for the new guidelines, and they talk about asthma history and specifically all sorts of markers for severe asthma, severe chronic asthma. There's also an emphasis on the social history and for how that plays into it, including low socioeconomic status, illicit drug use, and then also major psychosocial problems. And you may have heard Bob Strunk in St. Louis. He's been talking about this for decades, about depression and anxiety and how that relates to risk of fatal asthma. And under comorbidities, you see things such as cardiovascular disease, other chronic lung disease, and then again, psychiatric disease. And again, these are themes that there's not a lot of data on this, but these are the factors that seem to persist and seem to be independently related to risk of dying of asthma. Now, having said that, it's clear that if you have severe chronic asthma, you're at higher risk of dying of asthma. But the distinction between acute asthma severity and chronic asthma severity is an important one that's actually reflected in the new guidelines. Basically, if you have mild persistent asthma, you can die of an asthma attack. And I think we'd all agree that's about the worst type of attack you could have. So that would be very severe acute asthma, death. And that distinction, I think, is not highlighted enough in a lot of the literature. Always important, severe asthma to specify what are you talking about, the exacerbation or the chronic level of severity. And this paper goes back over a decade in Australia, where investigators tried to classify 51 children with asthma into their level of chronic asthma severity, and found, of course, that many of them were severe, but also that there were equal numbers of moderate and mild. And this has persisted. There aren't really good data since then to support or refute that. So one of my goals in doing the study was to look to see whether or not that was true. And I'm not sure we totally answer it. I'll show you the data. But there certainly are people with mild asthma who are dying. But I think we're shifting as we drop that number lower and lower to the people who die of asthma probably do have more severe chronic asthma. Bob Strunk, who's worked on this area for years, also talks about two types of asthma death, two scenarios. The first one is a slow onset, late arrival. And this is the one that has a lot of the psychological features, with social, cultural, economic factors, a disregard of the symptoms, an acceptance of the disability, and then a late arrival for care. And this is also associated with low use of corticosteroids and then death. The alternative is this type 2, which is a sudden onset where there's severe airway closure quickly and then death. And you can imagine it's very hard to study this. Your subjects are dead. And the families, when you interview them, they all think that it happened suddenly. So this is some of the challenges that we ran into in our registry. But again, this is classically what people are describing for asthma death. So to the registry, you know, let's see if we can get some data on this. Well, when we began working on this, there were a few registries that were underway, funded by the CDC. One of them was in California, and they focused on ages 2 to 34. And you can see the numbers are quite small. I mean, 80 deaths, and they were able to get 12 interviews, 15% response rate. This is considered really good in the fatal asthma research world. People refusing, you can't contact them. In 2002, Michigan also did a state registry, and it's probably the best one available today. And there were 59 deaths. They got 28 interviews, or about a 47% response. And that is the highest by far. But again, limited to ages 2 to 34. Two other CDC-funded states just couldn't even get going. And I won't mention who they are, but they were funded to large amounts of money and just sort of collapsed because it's so hard to do this research. Well, we, being perhaps young and brash, thought, well, let's try it. We'll do it. And we did this through our network, which is the Emergency Medicine Network. And this was a group that started in 1996. Initially, we called ourselves the Multicenter Airway Research Collaboration. So you may have heard us the term about MARC. And very quickly, though, we learned that the problems with airway problems such as asthma are not so much the lack of some wonderful new drug. It's really more about public health issues and access to those medicines, which we know work. And so we started to shift the network more towards public health, with asthma being a wonderful example of a chronic disease that interacts with the emergency medicine community and vice versa. And we renamed the network the Emergency Medicine Network. And we have received funding from all sorts of groups and lots of publications in the last decade. And that's our website, mnet-usa.org. If you want to learn more about asthma exacerbations in the emergency department, you can go to that website and find all kinds of references on different issues that might be of interest. Our network is across the United States and actually with some international sites, mostly in Canada, but a few in far-flung places. And what we set out to do was see if we could get a few states to do fatal asthma registries. And we got an unrestricted grant from GSK, and we're ready to launch this when we started running into all kinds of problems with the IRB and HIPAA and how this would be really challenging to do. But eventually we did get IRB and HIPAA approval at MGH, and we then went to three other states where we recruited investigators in Arkansas, Missouri, and Ohio, and the plan was for them to submit a standard protocol and see what happens. So the goal was not only to create a registry for 2 and older, and really to allow the full age range to enter into the registry, but also to test the feasibility of doing this, because there were lots of calls for building this registry and how important this would be, because it was so hard to learn anything about these people without a focused effort. Well, as I mentioned briefly, the methods were to look for asthma as the underlying cause of death, and this was done through the state vital statistics departments. The criteria were that you died between January and December 31 of 2004, which is the last year that I showed you on that trend graph, right? 3,816 Americans died of asthma. We're going to look within four states more closely at who those people are. There was no upper limit, and you had to be a resident of the state where the study was taking place. So if you happened to be traveling through Massachusetts, we would capture you, but then not pursue it. And the goal was to identify through the vital statistics, and what we would collect is through an interview as much as we could. And this was, in theory, going to happen by sending a contact letter to the families and then with an opt-out postcard. So we would write them a letter, and if they didn't want to do it, they would write back and say, no, we're not interested. Otherwise, we would call them. And we thought that with the IRB at Mass General and partners, we thought that was reasonable. We would then try to get medical records to confirm, medical examiner report if it was available, and then use an expert panel to review the cases and information to see if it really was asthma. Well, as I mentioned, at the start of the project, this big, nasty beast showed up and really just put a kibosh on everything. I mean, we were told it was impossible. This couldn't be done. So we chilled for a little bit, and late 2003, after the HIPAA had sort of arrived and people started to get comfortable with it, we thought, well, maybe we could start it. And that's how we chose 2004. But really, we parked it for about 2 years because of all the concerns and people basically saying, you just can't do this anymore in the United States of America. I'm going to conclude at the end of this that I'm not sure if you can do this anymore in the United States of America, even as we get to know HIPAA better and work around it, because it's just gotten so hard to get this information. And let me show you what happened in the four states. In Massachusetts, where we had the original plan, we had the opt-out, and we then would not need written permission to access the medical records. We would get them to agree to it. And it took us about 82 days to get IRB approval. And then we went to the other states, and to our disappointment, two of the states required an opt-in. So you basically would identify the families, write them a postcard, and they would have to say yes and mail it back to us before we could contact them. Now, what do you think that's going to do to participation rates? Disaster. The last one said, yeah, you can do an opt-out. And curiously, in this last one, the IRB said it would be fine to pay people, whereas our IRB said that was completely outrageous and unethical. So you got the full gamut, and we actually wrote this up describing some of this ambiguity and heterogeneity in IRB response and interpretation. And what happened ultimately was that states A and B basically got knocked out. Now, one of the states, Missouri, actually did get IRB approval, but at the state level, the person who was responsible for giving the cases found it very objectionable that he would provide death certificates to this IRB-approved investigator at Washington St. Louis just because he thought it was wrong. Now, death certificates are public record in most states, including Missouri, but it was just not something that he felt comfortable with. So the project just stopped. IRB approves, done. Missouri's out. Goodbye, Bob Strunk. Next, who survives? All right, so we then go to Arkansas. Now, Arkansas had this opt-in. They did all the mailings. Very few people wrote back, so they're gone. And this left Massachusetts and Ohio. And in Ohio, I was working with David Lang, who has experience in this field. And we did identify, through the vital statistics, about 212 cases, which gave us a population rate of about 12 to 13, which was right where it should be nationally, 13 per million. We completed 63 interviews, which was 30%, which was kind of right in the middle. I was happy with that. And medical records, we actually got 70% of our interviewees to have some medical records to verify. And I think the major finding, which was confirmed not only in the registry of all cases but also in the interview, is that fatal asthma has really become a problem of the elderly. It's not the classic young asthmatic that you read about. And here's a graph showing the age distribution, and you can see that many of these cases are getting on the older side here. I have to be careful with my language. Very few, I mean literally two, were children. So if you want to study pediatric fatal asthma, you're good luck, my friend. It's just not going to happen. And so what we're doing increasingly is we're studying fatal asthma in this age range, and you can imagine the challenges of dissecting COPD from asthma, and that's something that I'll show you shortly. From this group, the median age was 73 years old, and you can see the interquartile range from 52 to 86, two-thirds female, 89% white. The vast majority had a primary care provider, confirmed it on the interview, and also with medical records. We could see that they had it. And interestingly, about 50% had an asthma specialist. Now, we couldn't confirm what was meant by that, but I can assure you that the question was asked, you know, primary care provider, and then do you have someone extra who's an asthma specialist? So I was surprised by that, because I think the common lore is that these folks just aren't at all in the system. So again, this is one of the findings. Looking at the clinical characteristics, 40% of the cases had asthma only. And this was asking the family and going through the records. You just couldn't find evidence of another problem. But 45% of this group had also COPD and gave both of conditions. 15% had other problems and specifically couldn't confirm asthma. So when you see that 3,800, I'm telling you, it's already inflated because it's going to have some COPD in there. It's going to have some other conditions, even despite cleaning and scrubbing at the CDC. So the number is even lower out of 25 million people with asthma. In the past year, when we asked the families about depression and anxiety, we did, in fact, get very high numbers. And I think these are considerably higher than you'd expect in this population. And in the emergency department, where we've done some work on depression and in the past year, and we're finding rates of 30%, which are actually quite high. But here you're seeing there's rates as high as 70% in the individuals who died of asthma. 80% of them had a history of being admitted for asthma before. And surprisingly, 55 to 70% were on inhaled steroids before they died. So again, not what I would have expected. Only 40% of all the cases were on Advair. And we didn't find anybody who was on salmeterol alone. But again, I think that's an important number we'll return to. Looking across the group, 25% died in the hospital, so more and more of these people outside the hospital. And this number is consistent with a paper by Jerry Krishnan that was published in the Blue Journal in late 2006, where he estimated that about 33% of all deaths are in the in-hospital setting. So again, we're seeing now the majority of deaths out of hospital. In terms of the timing and the scenario types, the family members largely said it was sudden. Unfortunately, when you look at the medical records to get some confirmation of that, it just generally was not recorded. So we can't really resolve that issue of the two scenarios. But the family members did, the majority of them, say that there was a treatment delay, for what it's worth. And when you ask for the most common reasons, it was a tie between they were too sick to get care, which is an interesting concept, which speaks a lot to the barriers that are involved in getting care. But also tied there for first was lack of money and insurance, which is a little depressing. And again, these are the data that we collected. So in summary, the fatal asthma registry may be feasible in some states. It took a lot of work. I don't see this happening naturally without some real championing at the local level. The HIPAA certainly slowed us down. It blocked enrollment. It's just every step of the way. And also the state health departments, underfunded, too busy, hard to make the case that they should divert resources to this condition that we all are very interested in. It seems so tragic when a young person dies of asthma, but what I'm describing to you here are elderly individuals with asthma mixed with COPD, small percentage. It's going to be hard to get state health departments to divert resources to this problem. From our data, the asthma deaths are elderly, especially women. Most cases have a recent history of depression and anxiety. Most of them are on inhaled steroids, contrary to what we might have thought, suggesting they have at least persistent asthma, and only 40% used ELABA in the 4 weeks before death. All right, so let's move on. The final issue I want to talk about is this LABA controversy and how LABAs relate to asthma mortality. And if you are familiar with the guidelines, the old guidelines had, at the moderate persistent level, the preferred therapy being inhaled steroid with LABA, a combination. The new guidelines actually took what was described by some as the Great Missouri Compromise, which was to give you an option. And this was reflecting the concern of some committee members that LABAs may increase risk of asthma death. And if you were concerned about it, you had this medium dose alternative. Now, I can tell you that on the committee, my sense was that most people were pretty comfortable with the combination therapy, but really out of respect for this issue and these individuals who championed this, the thought was, if the provider is concerned or the patient is concerned, go with medium dose. And that should give you the bulk of the benefit. But my own personal opinion is that step three still should be combination therapy. And we'll return to this shortly. All right, so salmeterol, approved by the FDA in 1994, and this is the long-acting beta agonist, of course, in Advair. It's a known bronchodilator. It may have some weak anti-inflammatory effects. And Advair is, the two of them together, approved in 2000, so after 6 years of use of salmeterol in the public. And it was the first treatment to address both components, the inflammation and the bronchoconstriction. And if you look at the evidence on combination therapy versus inhaled steroid alone, there's two Cochrane reviews. Here's one of them. Again, very clear that in numerous RCTs that the combination is superior to the monotherapy. And here's a second review, which is looking at combination therapy versus higher dose inhaled steroid. And again, very clear, and no question that the combination therapy is working better. So why is there a controversy? Well, you all may have seen this article in the New England Journal, came out by Fernando Martinez, calling for an urgent need to clear the air, raising concerns about the safety of long-acting beta agonists. Followed very shortly, literally within days, by a review in the JACI saying, no, there's nothing here, don't worry about it. Now, both of these people were on our committee, so you can imagine the debate that was held. And this really was the only contentious issue of the EPR3. Lots of hours spent discussing this. But this is the controversy. And it all, you know, most of it stems back to SMART. There was an earlier study looking at salmeterol and suggesting perhaps some harm, but SMART was really the thing that drove it. And SMART, just briefly, 28-week, multi-center, randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial, aimed to enroll 60,000 patients, including patients of more than 12, who were on an asthma medication, whatever that might be. It could literally be just albuterol. You had to not take a long-acting beta agonist to get in. All therapy was taken as an outpatient. Subjects were enrolled, and it was very simple design, randomized either salmeterol with whatever you're on or placebo and whatever you're on, and then we'll contact you every 4 weeks, and we'll see whether or not you're alive. And that's basically the design. So what happened? Well, the randomization, nobody is going to dispute, was outstanding. 13,000 people in each arm, very similar groups. And you can see it is a sicker population with a peak flow that was in the low 80s in both sides. Despite this, when you look at these baseline groups, the majority of patients were not on inhaled corticosteroids. And this study was started in 96 and was running 97, 98, 99, 2000. I mean, it was running right through EPR2, where you would have expected that most of these patients should be on inhaled steroids. So that is odd in and of itself. But it just kept going and running to see if we could answer this question about whether or not salmeterol itself increases risk of bad events, including death. If you look at the population stratified by race, there's a very familiar story, a sad one, which is that the peak flows are lower in African Americans, and as you can look, across every one of these, it's worse in the African American group. And 38% of them were on inhaled steroids versus 49% of the white participants being on inhaled steroids. So again, a disadvantage at baseline for the African American participants. And here are the main results. You've all seen these. It is the major story in fatal asthma, though, and my update could not happen without telling you this. 13 deaths in the salmeterol group, 3 in the placebo, carrying an increased relative risk for asthma-related deaths. Now, here's the number that I want you to look at, which is this 8. Now, what does that mean? It's 8 excess deaths per 10,000 patients treated. And if you take that number and you then translate it out to larger numbers of people, well, 10,000 patients would supposedly give you 8 extra deaths, 100,000, 80, 1,000,000, 800, 5 million people using salmeterol, 4,000. You see where I'm going with this, because if this number is true, and this estimate would, if enough people in the United States use salmeterol, we would see some pretty massive changes in our trajectory of asthma deaths, just the numbers. Well, let's dig a little deeper, just 2 slides on the results. The primary endpoint is often forgotten in all of this discussion. And the primary outcome was respiratory death or life-threatening experience, established a priori, not significant. In the white group, absolutely null. There's nothing going on here. But in the African-American, it looks like there is something going on. Dig deeper, look at the secondary outcomes, and you see here's asthma-related death with huge confidence intervals, very small numbers, and there's the 13-3 that led to all the commotion. So when you look a little more closely, it's not, in my opinion, it's not so clear that this is real, but it is what it is. Here's another look at the patients, and the study was not designed to look at this question, either race, subgroups, or ICS usage. But when you do look at the ICS usage, you see, in general, a pattern that the people on ICS had lower risks of these different outcomes. But again, not designed to do that, and the FDA specifically saying we should not look at these data. But I can't see how any clinician who treats patients with salmeterol and inhaled steroids, according to the guidelines for over a decade, wouldn't want to know this, because these are the patients that how you're treating them. So now hopefully you're not putting people on medications and then calling them once a month to see if they're dead. Generally, that's not recommended clinic practice. If people aren't doing well, you adjust their medicines, et cetera. So one could argue that the whole trial has no relevance to current practice and follow-up. Well, so having said that, what can we learn from SMART? Well, it appears that treatment with salmeterol compared with placebo did result in a higher incidence of asthma-related deaths, or asthma-related life-threatening experiences, and then respiratory-related deaths alone. I mean, it is trending in that way, and it is a randomized double-blind trial. The data, though, are not adequate to determine whether or not concurrent use of inhaled steroids changes this, but it seems that it might. And it might just be because when you use inhaled steroids, you lower the risk of death in a very nice way, and so now you don't have enough there to see. And I know that sometimes frustrates people who advocate that long-acting beta agonists can kill you, but that's okay. If we lower the risk so that it's so low that you can no longer see the harm, guess what? There's not a lot of harm. And that's the point. And we know from numerous trials that there's a lot of benefit. So I think that's fine. Finally, we learned from this that beta agonists are obviously in a class of asthma medications, and that this may represent a class effect. And there's another paper on high-dose formoterol that suggested that there was an increased risk of intubations. And so that, again, this class effect, I think if there is something here, it probably does extend to all of them. Now, the FDA reaction to this was to put on a black box warning. The initial reaction was a little clumsy, saying that you could only use these medications after people had failed a medium dose, but that was immediately, but after a big brouhaha, was pulled back. And then in March 2006, a new final version came out, and it's summarized here, the black box warning. that combination therapy, and this applies to both Advair and Symbicort, is for patients not adequately controlled on other asthma controller medications, for example, low to medium dose inhaled corticosteroids, or again, giving lots of license to the clinician for patients whose disease severity clearly warrants initiation of treatment. I mean, that's pretty open. And the new guidelines are completely consistent with this. So sometimes I've heard clinicians who are nervous about using combination therapy because of legal implications. You now have the FDA and the new guidelines in sync, basically saying if you think they need it, use it. So I think those legal concerns really are moot right now. The second part of the black box warning is the actual presentation of the data we just reviewed, the 13 deaths and the three. So how could this happen? How could we get this result? And there's a few different explanations. One of them would relate to drug toxicity in a subset. So maybe a subset of the patients had adverse effects from overuse. And these would be things like hypokalemia, cardiac tachyarrhythmia. And I would just point out again that the design really was not the best for this issue because it invited problems. You start people on medicines and then you let them go. They have a 6-month supply. And there really isn't any adjustment or follow-up or beyond, hello, are you there? So again, I think that wasn't so helpful for clinicians. The other thing that is certainly a focus of a lot of attention is the possibility that these single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs, in the beta 2 receptor gene might play a role here. And that was quite popular. I'm glad to see it's kind of dampening down a little. But for a while there, it seemed to be common knowledge that the reason why the African Americans had more bad outcomes was because they tend to have more of this ARG-ARG polymorphism. And there was some evidence, largely coming from this institution, suggesting that ARG-ARG homozygotes may have a reduced or adverse response to beta agonists, with two papers by Israel and Wexler. Now, this is under dispute. I think I'm seeing Elliot smile, by Eugene Bleeker, who published 2 weeks ago a paper showing that, in his view, there is nothing going on between the polymorphism and the long-acting beta agonist. And I've been promised by Elliot and others that the American Thoracic Society will get the answer with some results from the ACORN. So I think this is going to be the big story of fatal asthma this year. Will probably be at the American Thoracic Society. And if the ACORN experience is null, this thing will be silenced. If it's not, then we'll go back to the drawing board and try to figure out what's the difference between the studies. But I'll tell you, as an explanation for the mortality findings, it's just already shut and closed. It doesn't make any sense. And I'll show it to you graphically. This is, pretend this is the SMART study, all the people in it. And about 80% of them are white, about 20% African-American. And we know that about a sixth of them have ARG-ARG, and yet it's more common in the African-Americans, where it's about one-fifth. You can look at this and say, okay, this is the at-risk group. If this was the explanation, what would be the race of the majority of the deaths? It wouldn't be African-American. It's just mathematically does not make sense. And so I still, I mean, even a week ago, heard somebody telling me that the ARG-ARG is the reason why the African-Americans had it worse. It just doesn't make any sense with basic math. You know, they should be largely white, and they're not. So it has to be, if this is true, it has to be some other factor interacting. And I would argue, just move on beyond this, it's probably related to the fact that having darker skin leads to delayed medical attention for a variety of reasons, and that symptom relief from the beta agonist masked awareness, and certainly the study design invited these kind of problems. And I can show you some evidence to that, which is if you look at the SMART data at how people were recruited, it was divided up into two phases. In the first phase, the patients were enrolled through print, radio, television advertising. This is a bus stop. You know, do you want free medicines? Whatever you're on, just come on in. If you're on something, whether it's albuterol or primatine mist, and we'll give you a free medicine called salmeterol. In phase two, when the recruitment was lagging, the trial was dragging, the FDA was saying, look, you really have to finish this project, the investigators in prior studies sponsored by GSK were approached and said, please enroll some of your clinic patients in our study. So very different. Early on, bus stop, et cetera, free meds. Later, in a clinic, more like your practice. And what you see is that the bulk of the deaths happen in that earlier phase, with very few deaths in the second part. And for a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial, this raises a lot of concerns in my mind that this isn't biology. You know, when the recruitment technique seems to influence the results, it suggests that there could be other things going on. And so I find this sort of concerning towards any causal conclusion about labas and mortality. Now, it didn't stop people from throwing fuel on the fire. And this was a horrible meta-analysis in the Annals of Internal Medicine in 2006 that concluded that 4 in 5 asthma deaths are due to LABA, that this is an epidemic like in New Zealand where we had there was a fatal asthma epidemic from beta agonist use, a specific high potency beta agonist. This was picked up by the British Medical Journal in this short piece. You know, the analysis concludes that 4,000 of the 5,000 asthma deaths are due to these drugs. This even made it into Time magazine and the annual summary of what's important in health under asthma. The only fact was this. And it really has many of us, myself included, pretty upset, because not only are there not 5,000 deaths, but it's impossible that there be 4,000 due to salmeterol if 4,000 people aren't even on salmeterol. And from our own data, I showed you that it's 40% of them are on it. I mean, how can it cause death if they're not even on it? And also, this whole idea that this was like New Zealand just shows a complete lack of understanding of the New Zealand asthma epidemic. This is the New Zealand asthma epidemic, where you look across the years and you see in different countries, this is now going back to 1959 through the mid-80s, and you see this first asthma mortality peak in the UK. Frank Spicer was obviously a very instrumental person in discovering this and describing it. And then the New Zealand peaks is shown here. There was an early one and then a later one. I mean, this is drama. This is clear and coming down nicely when the product is taken off the market. Meanwhile, in the United States, where these high-potency products were not available, there's just nothing going on. But if we're going to see salmeterol and formoterol causing a New Zealand-like epidemic, I want to see these sort of spikes as an epidemiologist, especially when you think about the tremendous market share that these products have gained. And here you see salmeterol sales from the 1994 approval all the way through 2005, dramatic increases with now about 20 million or more prescriptions being made every year. Now, if you think that typically an individual fills about 4 prescriptions a year, that would represent about 5 million people. And so remember those numbers, 5 million people, 4,000 deaths. If there's something going on here, and Smart is right, this is just impossible. It doesn't describe it. I mean, we would have a doubling of the risk. It'd be off the map. And instead what we see is here's the release of salmeterol, here's the release of Advair, and here's the release of formoterol. There's just no evidence of anything remotely resembling New Zealand. And there are not 5,000 deaths, and it's impossible that this accounts for 80% of them since people aren't even on it. And you can't die of it if you're not even on it. So in closing, you know, we do have this step 3, and I do still think it was a wise decision to offer both, because I think if a patient's concerned about it, if you're concerned about it, despite what I've presented, then choose a medium dose. You'll get the bulk of it. But I want to emphasize that if your patient does not achieve control on step 3 therapy, do not then just skip to the next step. Instead, slide upward. I think it's better to take somebody and put them on low dose with combination rather than skipping right to the next step as you're instructed to medium dose inhaled steroid. So this is the only place in the steps and control dance where you're not going to just go right to the next one, but instead slide up to what I think should be the first choice, which is the combination therapy. So with that, I'm going to summarize that asthma mortality is decreasing, and it's very good news, and I don't see any reason why it should not continue to decrease. despite there being more people with asthma today than 10 years ago, dramatically more. Fatal asthma research has become very difficult in this IRB HIPAA era. I'm skeptical about registries and if they can really happen, especially as the number of people with this problem continues to go down. And I'd also note that asthma mortality is largely an issue of the elderly now, and also of women. And anybody who does epidemiology and asthma knows that elderly women are a group that a lot of them have COPD and are being undiagnosed as COPD. So that further underscores how this problem is shrinking. So I was going to maybe call this talk the RIP of asthma mortality, because I think, you know, it is wonderful the progress that's been made over the last 20 years, in large part because of some of the people in this room in controlling the epidemic. I think that the ongoing concerns about the LABAs are, again, in my opinion, grossly overstated. It's certainly worth studying. It's important to study. The beta receptor research is important, fundamental science. It should continue, but as an explanation, it's really lacking. And then I finally spoke about a practical point, which is in step three therapy, when you do not achieve control, do not just skip to the next step. Instead, slide up to low dose with long-acting beta agonist for management of moderate persistent asthma. And that's something that's not really clear in the guidelines. So with that, I'll stop. We have about 10, 15 minutes for questions. And I'd also be happy to hear the opinions of some of our esteemed members in the audience. Thank you.